Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
This week we talk about Brexit.
What's the maths? Will it ever work out? Then I talk to Jude Christian about her new play, Othello Macbeth.
Plus, you ask us, should Vince Cable resign?
Stephen, Parliament is back next week. And do you know what else that means is back?
Our juddering march towards a chaotic Brexit?
Yes. Yes, it is. So can I check in on that? Because obviously the big story of the week in political terms is we've got a trade deal lined up with South Africa. Pretty excited about that. Big bonus coming for Liam Fox come Christmas time. But how are the old votes looking? Because I see something about it being kicked back from the crunch period, the indefinitely delayed crunch period, going now back to November.
The votes are looking bad.
Votes are bad.
Yeah. The central problem is there aren't enough of them.
For Theresa May to pass the Brexit.
For indeed, yeah, any form of Brexit. I did, mainly for my own curiosity, I started doing a vague headcount of who are the Conservative MPs who will definitely vote against.
Even Chequers, let alone further concessions on Chequers.
Yeah, the thing, because although I think it's actually highly likely that a deal which will look vaguely like Chequers, i.e. in the single market for goods, within some type of customs union, a large degree of regulatory alignment with some kind of opt-out for free movement, something like that will exist. But it will be several degrees more of rule-taking even than Chequers, and it will be several degrees short of the full economic benefits of being in the single market and customs union proper. So the question you have to ask yourself are, one, will more than seven Conservative MPs vote against that? Yes. Then you go, well, what about the seven Labour leavers? Will they cancel them out? And I think one of the interesting things, and I think a lot of people, including people who cover politics, seem to have internalised, is deciding the Labour leavers vote against the Labour Party on close votes to be mean.
So when you wrote about this beforehand, you were talking about the kind of the seven circles of hell, but there's many circles of Labour leavers and some of them being willing to vote against on procedural stuff, but, you know, not on all votes, right? So there's a difference between the vote of a Kate Hoey and a who...
Kate Hoey and a kind of...
Caroline Flint on the fringes of that?
Caroline Flint, I would put in the kind of maybe 14, 16 sort of outer core of people who campaigned to remain and now are, for various reasons, in a much more pro-leave position. And so that kind of outer ring, your Caroline Flint's, your Gareth Snell's, Laura Smith will vote against anything that can be seen as stopping Brexit or softening it, particularly on free movement, which they see as a crucial driver of the outvote. But those people have and will vote for anything procedural and anything on an aspect of Brexit that they do not think carries any particular purchase in the country, which is why the customs union vote was so close, because the various people in the Labour Party who feel that the referendum result, basically because no one can plausibly argue that there's a popular mandate on customs one way or the other, right? It just was not a vote-moving issue. Then you have your kind of outer core of committed seven leavers who've campaigned to leave the European Union and the Eurosceptics of long standing. And then you essentially have a group of whom Dennis Skinner is the most prominent. Kelvin Hopkins, not currently in the Labour Party because he's suspended following allegations of sexual harassment, is another in that group. That's probably the group which, if things had worked out differently, Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell would be in, of people who are committed Brexiteers, but when it looks like the government might fall, they will mostly vote to bring about a fall of the government. And then you have your kind of Labour Leave core who have voted with the government essentially on every Brexit vote other than the question of whether or not to have a meaningful vote.
And actually Kate Hoey.
Kate Hoey, Frank Field, Graham Stringer.
So the obverse of that, though, is that you think there are seven Tories who will vote even if it will bring the government down.
Yeah, I think there are
who seven. Will vote to reject Chequers even if it will bring the government down.
Yeah, I think one, people understand that thanks to the Fixed Term Parliament Act, you can have it both ways. You don't need to trigger an election if you don't want one. Two, they believe, whether rightly or wrongly, then the idea that, you know, people like Michael Gove are sort of selling, which is, you know, you focus on getting out and then you can worry about, you know, finessing any terms you don't like later. They basically think that it's you've got to get out as properly as you can in 2019 because you will never escape if you end up in a indefinite transition.
So the thing that I think was really going to change the conversation this autumn is things becoming kind of slightly more real, and particularly those stories about what no deal means ramping up. I was this morning reading about the fact that the British and the French are at war over scallops. And apparently once Brexit happens, it'll be brilliant because we'll be able to... The unspoken thing seems to be like fire our cannons on French ships in order to defend our God-given and right to fish scallops in our waters around Britain. So that's good. I'm quite in war with France. People said they want, you know, people voted Brexit out of nostalgia. What could be more nostalgic than war with France?
It's true. It is the ultimate vintage British activity. I'm not convinced that stories about the reality of no deal will shift the votes in Parliament, because people have already made such a sort of thing of going, oh no, that won't happen. Oh no, that's Project
Fear. Is this your John le Carré buying a painting thesis all over again?
But yeah, it's also...
And people bought the fake painting and they will now swear blind that it's a real painting forever.
They will now swear blind that it's a real painting forever. But also, crucially, they can't exit from Project Fear as a narrative, because then how will they get any of the Brexits they want afterwards? The thing that lots of people in Westminster say is, oh, well, May will be fine because she will find some Labour votes from somewhere. Well, if a deal is not levy enough for Jacob Rees-Mogg, it's not levy enough for Kate Hoey. And this is kind of what I mean about how I think there's a problem that a lot of commentators, I understand why Labour activists see the prism of Labour leavers voting to prevent a general election as them being mean. I don't think it's particularly, you know, I think it's a bit juvenile, but it's understandable because they very badly want an election. That's the most important thing to them. And I can see how you can forget that if you are a committed Eurosceptic, the most important thing to you is leaving the EU.
Can I detour just to say, Graham Stringer, you wrote, who's one of these Eurosceptics we were talking about, you wrote a piece this morning about the possibility of him being deselected. There was another piece earlier in the week from, I'm going to say, Labour List, who had a long-term veteran organiser somewhere in the Wirral saying that things are getting really seriously hairy. And in your cover story last week, you talked about the fact that there are lots of MPs in Merseyside who are worried about deselection threats, and not all of them Labour. Frank Field is the obvious example, he's another Labour leaver, but more about the fact that there's a very well-organised momentum kind of movement there. There's lots of kind of people, hangovers from militant tendency, who are still knocking around in politics, who have kind of come back in. Tell me what's happening with the possibility, because how quickly could those deselections happen? If they, for example, a motion was passed at conference this autumn that made it easier to deselect, could you see Frank Field out and replaced by someone else in time for it to affect the votes? Or is the timescale of that just completely happening on a completely different plane?
It happens on a completely different plane. So if something has, a rule change has to pass conference twice, or it can be expedited if the NEC...
Two different conferences. Right.
Or the NEC can do things to expedite it. But one way or the other, parliamentary selections are effectively an issue about the composition of the 2022 Parliament, or, you know, whenever it happens. Not an issue of...
You're not going to get someone deselected and have a replace, not a by-election, but you know what I mean, an internal selection to replace them before then. It will be not allowed to re-stand next time.
Yeah, they won't be able to stand as the Labour candidate. So it doesn't have any implications for the parliamentary arithmetic this time. So there are sort of three separate deselection subplots going on in the Labour Party at the moment. There is the one against Labour leavers who, in the minds of many Labour MPs and activists, bailed out Theresa May on a procedural issue. I mean, so someone who is no fan of Jeremy Corbyn, who is themselves worried about deselection after the customs union vote, was spitting blood. And they essentially said to me, well, look, the customs union vote isn't going to stop Brexit. Yeah, everyone knows that Jeremy Corbyn is not going to backslide on leaving. This is just some people who've decided to sabotage us having an election. Now, I don't think that their analysis is correct.
But that's quite a comforting analysis if you're a more centrist MP, right? Is it like, oh, they're not coming for me. I can back them going for Kate Hoey or Frank Field or Graham Stringer, and it's not the same as them coming. Everyone will support them when they come support me when they come for me.
Yeah, and then there's the kind of the second deselection subplot is people like Chris Leslie, who are under a lot of pressure locally, but who have bluntly been loudly and vocally critical of the Labour leader. And again, people will kind of say, yeah, but Chris has kind of...
Do the crime, do the time.
Yeah, that's what people will say. Then there's your third... I realise I lied, there are actually four deselections.
Oh, Stephen!
Then your third is places that have a long-term history of left organising out with the Labour left, of people who have now come into the Labour Party, where, again, people think that is more indefensible. They feel that some of those MPs have deserved to keep their seats. But, again, Labour MPs will not be overly worried about it because, of course, most Labour MPs do not have seats which have large organised groupings out with the left of the Labour Party. Then your fourth one, which is kind of the game changer and the one to watch, is basically what happens if people who have, like, you know, who no one on this podcast has heard of, who voted with the Labour Party, who might, you know, privately in a conversation rolled their eyes at the idea of Jeremy Corbyn, but, you know, there is nothing you can say, yeah, who vote may have voted in No Country, there is nothing you can, yeah, if you Google their
run
name
of the
and
mill,
Corbyn,
like slightly Corbyn skeptic-y,
like, yeah.
But no more Corbyn skeptic than the average of the party, which is quite Corbyn skeptic and parliamentary party.
Yeah. So now my actual feeling is that most of those people will be fine, because actually people forget there is no button in Momentum HQ or no button in the Labour leader's office to make people in a distant constituency party remove their MP.
John Lansman should get that button.
Yeah, it would be a useful button for him. But yeah, I mean, and you saw this in the 70s and 80s, right? Most Labour MPs got through their selection processes fine. The point at which you would start to see proper panic in the Labour Party would be if people who were obviously in the fourth group started getting into some kind of trouble. In terms of the parliamentary arithmetic of Brexit, I think it actually makes it even harder for Theresa May, because the signal that Labour activists have sent is if you prevent a general election, you are likely to face an organised deselection thing. Because in all three of those cases, crucially, actually, it's basically united the local parties. There is no caucus of people going, defend the MP, which there would be in most places. There's just a caucus of people going, but this was a brilliant opportunity for us to bring the government down. What are you doing? Now, there are lots of Labour MPs who believe that our continued membership of the Single Market and Customs Union are important enough to the ability to do any left-wing policy afterwards, that they are willing to nuke their own careers in order to do it. However, they're not going to nuke their own careers for something which looks like checkers, right? You know, for the already quite significant economic harm of only being in the single market for goods. So the fact that those MPs now know that there are almost certain career-ending consequences to breaking the whip means their price has gone up. I can't see how May can meet that price without tearing the Conservative Party in two, which she obviously doesn't want to do, which means I think we are heading for an incredibly chaotic and disruptive exit.
That's the thing I find different about it, is actually trying to game plan it and do like the four-dimensional chess of it. You just run out of kind of going, I actually just genuinely don't know what happened. I mean, which occasionally you run into a political correspondent who go, that sounds terribly exciting. And you think, yeah, exciting in the kind of like, you know, may you live in interesting times kind of curse type of way, right? One thing I want to ask you quickly before we move on, my cover story this week is about why British politics turned toxic. Why is everyone so effing angry all the time? And I'm interested, why do you think the mood feels so sour and miserable when we talk about politics?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I mean, one, of course, we have now had a decade of near stagnant wage growth. Two, we've had a decade of public spending cuts. Three, social media means that people can express their anger more easily. So you have cause and proximity And I think that would be my thesis, although I'm sure you have a more developed one in your
group. No, it is a good thesis. I think definitely the kind of decline of economic growth, you know, you don't get that kind of 90s boom feeling where it's about like, hey, we're going to have loads of stuff to give away. What's the priorities about who we should give it away to? Instead, it's kind of like, particularly with those stories about refugee crisis and about climate change, it's kind of like, we're on the downslide now. Who's going to be able to hang on to kind of what they've already got, right? Which I think is a change. And specifically in regard to America, the research is kind of about, it particularly says that, you know, the dominant group have now started thinking of themselves as having an identity. So you have white Americans without college degrees beginning to think of themselves as a kind of coherent political movement, and one who both feel endangered by the threat of majority minority America, and also about, which I think applies to Britain too, the second bit, which is about America's decline as a world power. And I think there's definitely a lot of that in Brexit too, that kind of anxiety that comes with thinking, well, this country isn't really on the up again. And that's a nostalgia for empire, I guess, in the case of Britain, and a nostalgia for America as a kind of the undisputed single global superpower. But yeah, no, I think social media, and not just social media in the sense of allowing angry people to talk to each other, but the kind of very architecture of the internet is a big part of it. And Facebook, I think, has definitely got a huge role to play in the sense of the way that it doesn't do what broadcasters and journalists have always done, which is act as gatekeepers. And therefore, you know, what voices have been allowed to rise to the top and, you know, just done by the algorithm, as if the algorithm is kind of this sort of great finger of God that comes out of the sky. And they tend to be the angriest and not always the best informed voices. You've got a whole economy of, you know, grifters basically making money by pumping false information into Facebook, because there's no, you know, until now, there's been very little sanction on that. But yeah, well, you can tell it's quite a complicated thesis because I managed to write 6 pages about it, Stephen. 6 pages.
And maybe everyone a winner.
I should have basically written Twitter is a hell site and no one should ever go on it.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now I'm joined by Jude Christian, director of Othello Macbeth, which is running from the 14th to the 19th of September at Home Manchester and the 5th of October to the 3rd of November at the Lyric Hammersmith. Hello, Jude.
Hello.
I caught you just after rehearsals. We're here in the Lyric, not in our usual podcast bunker, in a very swanky podcast bunker. But tell me, I mean, I guess the title kind of the jig is up. It's Othello and it's Macbeth. But tell me why you wanted to kind of mash those two plays together. What was the kind of interest behind that?
So I wish I had some magical story whereby this was like a vision that came to me. But actually what happened is the Lyric came to me and said, we're thinking about doing Othello and Macbeth as a double bill. Do you want to direct it? And my first response was no. And I did that awkward thing where I sort of talked myself out of a job quite angrily for a few days and then went, fine, actually, I do want to do it. But I think my initial response was, I've never directed Shakespeare's plays before. I always loved Shakespeare when I was studying it at school and at university.
Did you though? Did you really?
Well, so I really loved the language.
Yeah.
I think I found it really exciting, and I find it exciting now when playwrights embrace lyricism and embrace metaphor and poetic language. I find it a bit weird when playwrights do that and people go, oh, drawing on Shakespeare, as if no one else has ever thought to write like that. But there we go. And, you know, there's so many iconic moments that you've sort of read and you've either dreamed about being in them or you've dreamed about putting them on stage. So I think there's something that feels really tangible and visceral about Shakespeare because it's so fed to us all the time. But equally, you know, as I've gotten older and seen plays performed again and again and again and looked at the world and looked at the stories that we tell about the world, particularly with Othello, I was like, why put on a play about a man who kills his wife and spends 3 hours banging on about why he's done it? Like, why put on a play which is 70% one man lying and another man going, it's really painful for me that my wife's cheated on me, when she hasn't cheated on him? And so I got quite angry and said that I wasn't interested in doing Othello. And then I went home and watched the entirety of the O.J. Simpson Made in America documentary for 9 hours, slightly hungover, and sat there going, oh my God, it's the story of Othello. And I hadn't quite realised that. And I thought that the documentary was fascinating because for the whole first half of it, it brilliantly dissected how America has a massive problem with race. Mm. And for the whole second half of it, it did not at all dissect how America has a problem with hugely successful sports stars assaulting or murdering women and getting tons of attention or getting spoken of as if that story is the tragedy of a hero falling from grace.
I think that's one of the things I find really interesting about Othello, and there's a big production on at the Globe at the moment, is the tendency to see it as the race play clouds out the desire to see it as the sexual jealousy play.
Exactly.
And actually, you really can't untwine those two from each other. You know, particularly Iago's jealousy is so clearly about the idea of Emilia having cheated on him. You know, that's and the kind of the white masculinity of him feeling that he's been usurped by this guy that he sees as being, you know, he's somehow lesser than him. So how, hang on a minute, why would a woman find him more attractive? And if you can't control your woman, then, you know, what can you control? But I think that some of that interplay between the two, I think it tends to, when people tend to bring the race element forwards, they tend to somehow lose the violence against women aspect of it and the jealousy aspect.
I think it's something that comes up all the time in conversations around intersectionality, is we find ourselves only capable of thinking in terms of there being a victim or an oppressor at all times. And we really struggle to hold in our heads, because I think what we need is to go, if there's a victim, they are innocent, they are blameless, they have done nothing wrong. Society has made this terrible thing happen to them. And the moment someone tries to suggest that they might have been in any way culpable or in any way have acted cruelly towards another person or have held privilege, we really reject the notion of it. And I think that comes up hugely in Othello, where you've also got Desdemona's huge amount of privilege in the way that she lives her life. And the sort of ambiguity around her relationship with Cassio and the way that she is talking to Othello about him, we're finding in rehearsals that we're having to constantly fight the urge to make Desdemona pure as the driven snow, because only then is her death unjust.
I think that's a really fascinating aspect. So yeah, there is a tendency to downplay any sense of flirtation with Cassio, because then you get this idea that, well, then she deserves, you know, that's really the underlying
assumption, which is very uncomfortable. As long as she's never looked at or touched him, she doesn't deserve to die. Whereas, you know, if she'd shagged him, then kill her.
Right, which is absolutely bizarre. Within the world of the play. You can feel that if she had sex with Cassio, then it would say, well, in that case, well,
yeah,
you know,
exactly. Then we'd be like, oh, well, yeah, no one really cares. So anyway, so all of this happened and I got very angry reading Othello. And then I was also, at the time I was working on a production with a company called Rash Dash. We were making a show called The Darkest Corners, which took place in a car park in Leeds. And it was about women being assaulted when they walk alone at night all over the world. And what the stories of that are, and also stories of women who are fighting back specifically with violence. That was one of the things that we explored in the show. And we had some quite interesting conversations about that energy that you have around that sort of thing, where you're going, A, the part of me that is angry and tired and sad, and also the part of me that grew up watching badass 80s action movies and secretly thinks that guns are cool, even though I know that they're abhorrent. We get that little jolt when we think about the notion that women might be able to right wrongs through violence, for example. And so I was thinking about Othello and Macbeth. I was thinking, maybe this is an opportunity. For example, maybe what I'll do is just cut all the scenes that don't have men in them. So without changing the action of the story, what I'll do is throw a focus onto Desdemona. You know, let's tell the story of Reva Steenkamp, not Oscar Pistorius. Mm. Let's acknowledge that this woman's life and her tragedy are so lost in the disproportionate amount of time that men spend talking about things in this play.
Can I say something that's probably... I mean, I've read the script of it, which is a really... I was going to say I have to give a spoiler alert, which seems a kind of very strange thing to do for Othello and Macbeth. But but one of the things when I first... I think I did Othello for GCSE, actually. And one of the things that was awful studying it then was that awful scene where Desdemona is preparing to go to bed and she starts singing Tit Willow, which obviously inevitably at the age of 15 was amazingly hilarious to us. But that idea that she is kind of just this passive... I think it's the passivity of her that I find really difficult to deal with. And the same, you know, and that's why it's an interesting contrast, I guess, with Macbeth, where, you know, you have Lady Macbeth as the engine constantly pushing Macbeth onwards to whatever it is that he's doing. There are two different, very different models of femininity. But yeah, my spoiler alert is that the way that you've structured it has Desdemona and Bianca and Emilia transmuting into the witches, right?
Yeah.
And then they get a lot of the second half is then Macbeth. They get a lot of the famous lines. They do tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And do they do Out Damn Spot, or is that still Lady Macbeth?
That's still Lady Macbeth, but they have Blood Will Have Blood. and so some of the big hits.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All the ones you're waiting for. But I thought that was so they kind of become almost like a chorus in the as well as taking on the roles of the witches and then also playing some of the other parts like the porter as well. Mm. So there's just a lot more women on stage a lot more of the time.
Yeah.
But how are the two plays bleeding into one another?
So I think the idea that I went with was you end Othello with three women who have been in various ways horrifically shat on. I mean, two of them have been murdered by their husbands, which is pretty bad. And then you have Bianca, who is sort of ignored by everyone. And you start Macbeth with three women who are on a quest to fuck with everyone for no apparent reason. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if they had a reason? And I guess, like I say, the part of me that was interested in this sort of like badass female revenge, when wouldn't that be an interesting in? And to start with, I started making a cut of the plays where I just worked that idea through. So I thought, okay, Desdemona, Emilia and Bianca, they have a reason. So the logic that I gave to the cast when we started rehearsing was they regenerate as witches, or they reincarnate, whatever, respawn. and so then they respawn the entire cast of Othello as the cast of Macbeth. But none of those people have any idea that they had a prior life. So I think the storyline that we're playing with is to those three witches, Cassio, this is massive spoilers, by the way, sorry, but it's fine. So Cassio becomes Macbeth. And I think that they know that Cassio used to be Cassio. So they all have a relationship and an attitude to him. And they have a purpose for him, I think. They have a mission that they want to play through the action of Macbeth. But Macbeth has no idea that he's a pawn in their hands. And that felt interesting because the witches play those characters. They play them in a very similar way to how Iago plays Othello. They give truths, or they give half-truths, or they give manipulative pieces of information, and they just sit back and see what those people do with them.
But I think this is interesting, having this conversation, because it feels like an autumn in which there's a lot of Shakespeare that's playing with different types of gender around the place. Actually, and further back than that, so Michelle Terry at the Globe has been casting gender blind. She played Hamlet, she had a male Ophelia in that. There was quite a bit of switching in Othello, the kind of the Doge of Venice was a woman, for example. We've got Measure for Measure coming at the Donmar, where they're going to alternate the roles they swap halfway through the play. I mean, I'm fully into that as being quite crazy, maybe even crazier than Othello Macbeth as a concept. But even, you know, even quite traditional, quote unquote, productions that are doing more, it's really not unusual to see, like the Almeida Hamlet had a female Guildenstern slash mm-hmm. Rosencrantz. I can't remember which one is which. But, you know, yeah, I guess fundamentally. So there is all of this, to my mind, springs from the fact that Shakespeare is our national writer. He's on the GCSE syllabus, he's on the A-level syllabus really often. Everyone has to do it at school. But there's what I think 7 male speaking parts for every 1 female speaking part in Shakespeare. And therefore, everybody's wrestling with something that is fun. What are the limits? How far can you update Shakespeare? What are the hard limits on that?
Well, I think you can do whatever you want. I think that there is a tension between, I'm going to say, traditional theatre criticism and what living artists might want to do with Shakespeare, because I think that quite often it feels like for criticism in general, there's a notion that it is about telling artists whether or not they've done a play right. I would say that is an attempt to impose some limits, but I think that you should be able to do whatever. And I definitely went into Othello Macbeth going, do you know what? I know this stuff really well because I had to learn it in school. I've been told that this tells me about myself. I've been told that this is my national identity, even though me as a mixed race woman from a village outside Milton Keynes don't feel like I see myself represented in these plays. So if it does belong to us, then we can do what we want with it. Our job as artists is to create art. Theatre is a weird art form because it's quite often, if you're making text-based theatre, composed of taking a piece of work which was an existence of its own and then reinventing it for the modern day. And I think that with varying degrees of fidelity to text, you can pick how you want to treat text and how far it's useful for you as an artist to sit within that framework. And then in this country, there are also rules around copyright to do with what you can do. But I think that in an ideal world, you could and should be able to use as much or as little as you like of the original words or the original intent of a play, because you're saying something personal in a new time and place for a new audience and with a new context.
I guess I'm just surprised that there aren't more updatings of Shakespeare and the plots. I guess everyone's just scared that he's such a brilliant writer. His use of metaphor is so brilliant that be like, oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess a rare example of it being Mike Bartlett's King Charles III, right, mm-hmm. which was in blank verse and was very Shakespearean in its themes. But it's quite ballsy or quite overish. I don't know which way we are until we say that, to kind of say, yeah, I'm going to do a Shakespeare play. But, you know, he was already updating existing plays yeah. and existing bits of history. And there is now a kind of attachment to this sort of like sealing him in aspic as our national writer that's sort of says, you know, how could I possibly kind of, as you say, there is a kind of like, you have to do Shakespeare right, which is nothing to do with how Shakespeare, you know, because no one's doing it with boys and in original pronunciation.
Yeah.
You know, and all of that. Even the Globe, which is quote unquote committed to our original practice, has still got lots of updating in it.
But I think there's such an academic weight behind Shakespeare, as well as a critical and a theatrical weight behind it, that I think it gives all of us the fear. Mm. Because I think you really see it with actors who come to engage with Shakespeare, how they feel they need to sort of position themselves in terms of their knowledge. And everyone is scared into having a deference towards it. And I think it's because we are told constantly, Shakespeare's sort of fated as some beyond human entity, which is, you know, kind of possibly because he just stole the brains of loads of other people and stuck their plays together and was very, very good at getting his name on it before anyone else. But we're so told that he's sort of this being beyond the comprehension of a normal mortal human that I think quite often we're either scared of getting it wrong or other people are scared of us getting it wrong. And because theatre is such a collaborative art form, you can't as an individual go, okay, death or glory. Like, here's my interpretation of it, and I'm just going to put it out there, because you need an entire company of actors, an entire design team, an entire theatre to get behind you before you even get your chance to put that in front of an audience. And I think, I have a weird relationship with it, because having never directed it, there's a part of me that's like got the fear, and I'm like, that's my first Shakespeare, I don't want to show off by like sticking two plays together. But also,
you
I think
other directors who mainly direct one Shakespeare play.
Exactly, it's what, like, come on, go big or go home. But I think for me there was a bit of a sense of, well, I can't imagine needing to prove that I can do Shakespeare properly, because I don't think that I want to be doing Shakespeare properly for my future career. So aside from the stakes of generally people potentially turning up and going, Jude's just rubbish at directing per se, I don't have the anxiety of going, I need to show that I'm sort of offering due reverence to Shakespeare in order to get my next production. I feel like I would want to direct Shakespeare in future potentially, although there are other things that I would much more want to direct, only on my own terms. And I think one of the joys of doing it, one of the reasons that people do it a lot, is theoretically, because it's out of copyright, you can mess with it. And there's a license in some ways to do that, because when we started talking about Othello Macbeth, and I was like, by the way, I'm going to cut most of the good speeches and whatever, I was
all
like...
Right, I should say that it's like 2 hours long, which I think for most people is a huge incentive to see it.
Cause... Well, yes. I mean, it's going to creep up slightly, but yeah, it's definitely not going to be more than... It definitely won't be more than three, and that's two for the price of one.
Right.
But I think I was like, there's like 17 other Othellos going on this year. There's a million other Macbeths. The plays will be fine. And I feel okay about, even if everyone in the world turns up and goes, I think you've got it wrong, I feel all right about getting it wrong. I think that's more useful than...
Cranking out a very standard Macbeth that does everything right and has everybody
in
period
dress.
Yeah, exactly,
and pointing everyone to the sort of footnoted Arden edition, in which I prove that there's definitely a justification that someone's written in their dissertation 15 years ago that means that person can say that line in that way. I think if we trust that he's that great and he belongs to us and we should be able to show his genius anywhere, then let's do what we want with it.
One final question. Best female role in Shakespeare?
Oh, man. I mean, they're really pants. No, they're not.
I think there's a lot of, I struggle with what I think of as the floaty women. So Desdemona and Ophelia, because I just think I've seen lots of really great actresses struggle in wafty dresses.
Yes.
You know, looking sort of all wan. And you just, and that, I find that I just sort of want to kind of go, oh, just pull yourself together.
Well, yeah, I think.
So the comedies I find better for that.
Yes, because they tend to be more front footed, don't they? I mean, I've got big love for Amelia in Othello. And it's fun when you carve out the space for her. And her journey is bizarre because in some ways she's incredibly switched on and cynical. And then she's also like, Iago, man who's not very nice to me, do you want this handkerchief that I found on the floor? I hope you don't do anything bad with it. So there are knots to be ironed out in her. But I find her chat really engaging.
She's practical, isn't she? I think that's one of the things, is that she feels like, she doesn't feel like a princess in a fairy castle. She feels like a human woman.
Yes, exactly. And a human woman who's already... dealing with some incredibly complicated crap at the beginning of the play. and wading her way through that. And I think she has such an interesting, she has so many interesting reserves of resentment and so much cause for resentment, not just towards obviously Iago, but Desdemona and various other people as well, that I find her spiky.
That's good. Spiky is good. That was Jude Christian. Othello Macbeth is on at home Manchester first, and then the Lyric comes with. And now for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
And this week you asked us about the Lib Dems, which is coincidental because you've also written your column on the Lib Dems. Should the Lib Dems get a new leader? Vince Cable got a lot of flack for missing a vote. Was it the customs union vote? Because he was talking about the launch of a new centrist party whilst not really realising that he was still leading an old centrist party, I guess the joke goes. But you don't think that Vince is the problem?
I don't think Vince is. I mean, so let's take, for example, that vote, which was effectively a problem that the Lib Dem whips thought that they had definitely lost.
Yeah.
And so they basically went, because Labour changed its mind. It was basically the classic problem that Labour was going to abstain because they thought they couldn't win. Then Labour basically thought, oh, actually, there are enough Tory rebels. Maybe we can win. In the end, because of the Labour leavers, even if you'd had every Lib Dem turn up, it wouldn't have mattered. But it only became important because of other decisions. I essentially think, one, if you're Vince Cable or indeed you're any Liberal Democrat leader, it's very important for you to be present at every conversation about a new centrist party, because you've got to handle it in a way that means that you are not immediately sort of swallowed and subordinated to it.
Right. Tim Farron was in the Politico morning email this week being interviewed in his constituency, and he said, you know, we will have to talk to whatever the party is if there is a new party emerges, right? Either that centrist party will swallow the Lib Dems or it will replace them in people's minds as the party that occupies that bit of space. So it is something they have to deal with.
Yeah. So that criticism, I kind of think, doesn't really apply. But the essential problems of the Lib Dems have, I just don't really think are the fault of or are fixed by a change of leader, right? He is coming up, you know, he has got a stated mission every month to come up with a new eye-catching policy idea to kind of make the party seem more dynamic and also to hopefully get it talked about. So far, those ideas have failed to catch fire. Some of those ideas are, in my mind, bad.
Go on, give me an example.
Well, scrapping Ofsted and removing the whole sort of architecture of school accountability, I think, is a bad
idea. That seems a bad idea, given that one of the established problems with free schools is that they don't have the accountability that the rest of the system has anyway and go straight to the Secretary of State, or at least they did when they were first set up.
And now, of course, you've got this hilarious thing with the DfE trying to create various, like, I can't believe it's not an LEA. We'll have a police authority because the mid-tier is actually quite an important way of making sure that schools work. But I think it's a bad idea. However, it's an idea, A, popular with some teachers, and B, the advantage if you're the third party with coming up with eye-catching ideas, good or bad, is hopefully people talk about you and remember you exist.
Drugs, you know?
Drugs, yeah, drugs is another place.
Classic Lib Dem issue.
Another thing that they've sort of they've talked about. They are trying to get a hearing on the fact that obviously, our prisons are in a state. Under Richard Bergen, Labour's critique is essentially that there isn't enough money going into it, which, I mean, it is true that prisons have been at the forefront of fighting, but we could also fix that by just sending fewer people to prison, right? Like, we do send too many people. So they're trying to do that. But their essential problems, right, are, why do we never write about them? Well, because they have 12 MPs.
Yeah, we write about them less than, because the DUP have a similar number and actually affect the government votes, right?
Yeah, they have 12 MPs. They have no real influence.
We don't write a massive amount about the SNP at Westminster, right? Which, you know, is because they act in quite predictable ways,
and also because their state, it is, you know, their main arena and focus is of course Parliament in Scotland. And when we write about Scotland, but also there is a crucial sort of revealing problem that having 12 MPs does create for you. Mostly when we write about SNP MPs, we write about specific campaigns mounted by backbench MPs, whether it was in the last
WASPI
parliament,
or period poverty, or child burial fees,
or the Turing bill in the last parliament. Obviously, if you have 45, it's not 45 anymore, if you have 30 odd MPs in your parliament, then you've got more chances to do that. And that problem does not go away if Vince Cable becomes a backbencher. The other problem is, of course, coalition and the electoral consequences of it. Only half of the country believes that the coalition was bad and has not yet forgiven them for it. The other half is split between people who think the coalition was bad and have forgiven them for it, believe that the coalition was good all along, although in some cases that is the classic sort of people who've changed their mind, who are pretending they haven't changed their mind. And then another group who think the coalition was bad, but think that the Lib Dems did the best job they could, given the circumstances, right? Now, of course, the problem the Lib Dems have is that they are only fishing for votes in that pool of the half of the country, which, for one reason or another, feels the coalition was not an unforgivable sin. Now, as time goes on, the number of people who feel that the coalition was not an unforgivable sin goes up. But it is hard to... I don't buy that they can sort of expedite that by having, you know, a fresh leader who wasn't in coalition. I also think, and actually, as someone who is perhaps more, because I feel that probably our views on the Lib Dems have exactly switched, and then you were probably more well disposed to them before they went into coalition.
Yeah.
Whereas I was more well disposed to them afterwards.
Well, I was more in my 20s. I was much more liberal than I am now, in the sense of much more quasi-libertarian, in the sense that my views were much more, people should be allowed to get on with what they want without the state interfering. And I've got to become more statist as I've got older.
Well, I think that the thing I essentially found weird about the Lib Dems before coalition, right, is if you are the third party in first past the post in particular, your best hope is that you get into power and then you can soften off the edges of the governing party that you don't like, and you can get a couple of your issues through as well. And on that metric, they were incredibly successful in coalition, in a parliament in which, I'm sorry, again, maths is a thing, the numbers were not there for any other alternative government. But they were, in my view, and then in 2015, they had a manifesto which actually was very sober and it was very accurate about what a third party can actually achieve in parliament. Mm. Right? But they were punished, sort of, in my view, fairly, albeit at the wrong time, for running an election in 2010 and 2005 based on the idea that they were going to be able
majority,
to...
Majority, yeah.
Effectively based on a false premise. Now, the problem I think they have is that, in an odd way, the good thing about the coalition is that it means that they can't go back to that kind of, our big policy is we need to build more houses, but all of our MPs have campaigned against building houses, you know, campaigned against the local Labour Council building more homes, right? Then the coalition should mean that they, does essentially mean voters don't trust them to do that kind of thing anymore. The problem is, I think a critical mass of their activists and some of their MPs still would like to go back to that. And essentially, what they need to get to is a situation. So this is why I think this idea of, oh, well, you just get rid of Vince Cable, then you have someone like Leila Moran who's not tainted by coalition, doesn't work, because at some point they're going to be tainted by coalition again.
It also doesn't, as well, isn't it just a replay of, let's have Ed Miliband, not David Miliband, because he didn't vote for the Iraq War because he wasn't in Parliament at the time. And it's like, just because someone hasn't done a thing that you all hate isn't a qualification in and of itself.
Yeah, but I also think the thing is, right, is with the Ed Miliband, like, Labour disavowing the Iraq War did undoubtedly help it win back some votes. And those votes have remained with it after a change of leader. And ultimately, I can't work out how Labour will... It's not built in that Labour has to lose those votes at some point in the future.
Yeah.
Whereas trying to win back the votes of people who...
Yes, we're not going to invade Iraq again,
yeah.
I hope.
Whereas, like, trying to win back the votes of people who... are annoyed with you behaving like a junior coalition partner in a coalition, when you are a party whose best aim under our electoral system is to become a junior coalition partner again, is mad.
But they could assume you'd think that next time the Lib Dems would insist on a supply and confidence arrangement like the DUP have. Do you think the DUP will get punished for being part of a supply and confidence arrangement and propping up a Conservative government? I don't think they will.
No, but that's because they're the major party in...
I guess because of the sectarian concerns, and also because their economic policy is so aligned with Conservatives, and because Conservatives don't compete in seats against them, all of that matters. But
yeah, it is just a very different electoral dynamic. But I also just think, in general, so it is always hard for the junior coalition partner, but the Lib Dems made it harder for themselves because they never really explained
what
they were for, what they were doing, and they placed too high a premium on making it on coalition BC, on winning the argument for... Because they thought what they need to do is go, coalitions can work. that shows if we change the electoral system and have more coalitions, that would be a good thing, rather than going, our participation in this coalition has worked. Whereas, of course, the DUP's bottom line is always, what is the thing that we can say we have delivered as a result of our political participation in this alliance?
I mean, look at all this sweet, sweet money that we got for Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, I think coalition is always preferable to confidence and supply. You can achieve more with ministerial office, right? Even if it's just small things like, yeah, if you're the Home Office Minister, you can change the guidance given to the border force. You can change. There are so many non-legislative things you can do as a junior partner. But that means that they should be focusing on winning over voters who accept they are going to be in a coalition, rather than, and maybe that only means that they can only ever get 30 seats. But seeing as it looks likely that we will have, you know,
that's still a great number of seats to have in the next parliament, if you think how the opinion polls suggest how hung that's going to be.
Yeah, and imagine for a moment that the Lib Dems had in 2010 had 30 seats. Well, they would still have held the balance of power. And let's say those 30 seats are people who are more willing to accept the compromises of coalition. They would have been in a more powerful position. One of their big problems was by 2012, it was essentially clear that the Lib Dems could not politically plausibly threaten to pull the plug on the Conservatives because they were going to lose seats. Just in every possible way, their problem is coalition. Their other problem is a bunch of them want to kind of etch-a-sketch the coalition away. Neither of those will be fixed by changing the leader. What they instead need to do is accept that coalition means there are a different political party than they were in 2010.
Demand better. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Stephen's free morning email is returning next week along with Parliament, so head over to the New Statesman and subscribe or Google Stephen Bush Morning Call.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.